Mr. Burke.
May it please the court. Wren Dean is rock solid precedent. The question today is what happens when Wren Dean is not followed at all, is what this comes down to. Not even lip service hasn't been by plaintiff's counsel in terms of submitting the requisite proofs. That put the trial court on the horns of a dilemma, and the trial court made repeated requests to get the submissions possible. It should be emphasized enough that the trial court's decision did not come in response to the initial submissions by plaintiff's counsel, came after repeated communications to remedy undisputed defects, unsworn certifications, not complying with the requirements of RPC 15A in terms of the background credentials that are required, and not satisfying the factors set forth in Wren Dean. That's separate and apart from the issues with the timesheets themselves, with the amount of time spent on things. In response, we still have issues with plaintiff's counsel not submitting certifications as to the market rate that's applicable. We instead receive statements from one attorney who's not even practicing and one who has no knowledge of the New Jersey market and otherwise doesn't practice employment law. We are told yet again today that statements without the rule required language under 144 can still be a certification. It's a matter of opinion. It's difficult to fathom that, considering that the language is either there or it's not. In any event, even if they were sworn certifications, they don't go to the crux of what the analysis has to be as to what the market rate is for an employment attorney. Monmouth County, Central Jersey, New Jersey, none of those submissions were made. In the normal course, when those submissions weren't made, in the prior precedent, plaintiff's counsel refers to other cases where rates have been set without certifications by other counsel. It doesn't cite to any. We note that even in Wren Dean, before there was a Wren Dean Supreme Court, the plaintiff submitted certifications from other counsel as to what the market rate should be. So long-term precedent as to how the market rate gets set for an hourly rate for an attorney. Completely ignored. So what happens is the court's on the horns of a dilemma, the defendants are on the horns of a dilemma, is how does the court make a decision? Because this is unlike other elements of LAD damages, where if a plaintiff doesn't submit sufficient proofs, they're not awarded damages. For instance, Mr. Hansen, this matter, did not submit sufficient proofs to be rewarded with emotional distress damages, so he received none. But here, the court and the precedent seems to indicate that plaintiff is entitled to damage attorney's fees even if the proofs aren't there, even if the proofs are not there after repeated submissions. So the court then undertook an extremely painstaking analysis based on what was available to it. And that was primarily what defendant's counsel submitted in terms of unpublished opinions, because as we've spoken ad nauseum about this morning already, there are virtually no current published opinions. Unpublished opinions were submitted for lack of anything else, because maybe they would recognize that there would be the problem, are they unpublished opinions that can't be followed, or can they be given some evidential value? Something had to be given to the court to make a decision rather than just pulling it out of thin air. Those decisions had a range of rates, which were substantially lower. There was not one decision, as discussed by plaintiff. There were 10 separate decisions and multiple counsel with a range of experience that were addressed in those opinions. So it wasn't just one unpublished opinion that was submitted. There were numerous, fairly as recent as could be, unpublished opinions that addressed a range of rates, a universe of rates. And they showed that plaintiff's requested rate of $7.25 an hour was $200-something more than the highest rate that ever had been rewarded. And that was being sought without the benefit of any proofs whatsoever, especially proofs addressing the factors such as experience, number of cases, certified trial attorney, member of the bar association, member of any of the bar associations, employment law associations, nothing. But so that is what the court made its decision on. Plaintiff keeps saying that the court made its decision based strictly on its feel. That's a significant exaggeration of the court's opinion. The court made a decision based upon the best available evidence presented to it. and that was the unpublished decisions that, and then its feel and its knowledge of other opinions then served as sort of a sanity check, for lack of a better term, sort of a sense of where the guide rails might be and how accurate this might be. So
the court also said it relied on its own experience. Was that appropriate?
I don't know. I would say it didn't rely upon its own experience to set the rate, but just set the rate to consider whether the rates that were being considered were reasonable. Normally, the court should not be relying upon its own rate. Normally, there should be certification submitted by plaintiff's counsel, along with from practitioners of employment law, as Mr. Green mentioned. That's the way it's been done under Rendine up until this case. There are plaintiffs get other plaintiffs' attorneys to submit the rates. And be candid, I don't recall seeing a decision where defendants then go out and get their own set of plaintiffs' attorneys that submit competing rates, and that there's this dispute over, you know, how much, you know, by a few dollars. It, normally, the issue is decided by the court based upon the plaintiff's submissions of comparators and peers of the plaintiff's attorney. And that's how it's normally done. Fortunately, this was far from a normal circumstance. I don't know how much farther out the court gave great latitude towards plaintiff, every opportunity to do it. At some point, the court had to make a decision. But now, in response to that, we discussed this morning all sorts of processes or considerations to make these fee applications more complicated. There's prior Supreme Court precedent that talks about not turning these fee applications into mini trials and dragging these out unnecessarily. But one of the suggestions in a circumstance such as this is when there are no proofs as to the attorney's hourly rate, should a special master be appointed who would then go about that. Certainly, I believe there have been certain hearings. I don't know if it was a special master. I believe there is precedent as to hearings. I would question whether or not that should be as a matter of course in any case, because it certainly complicates matters. And there's also the potential of duplication of work. If you have one special master determining what the reasonable hourly rate, for example, Monmouth County is, it doesn't make sense that you would then have a second case or a third case where they're duplicating that work, which would then suggest that perhaps there could be some other way of notice the bar survey to set hourly rates. But otherwise, there is no public data point. There's no way to go out. There's no survey. There's no book. There's nothing to say what an hourly rate is. Frankly, there's no way to even know if there's a difference in hourly rate between Monmouth County versus any other county in New Jersey, or if there is, what the market truly is, and if there is a difference in rate. So that's the issue with the rates. I think addressing the issue of limited success that Mr. Green also raised, there's, you know, that by nature is supposed to have judicial discretion. It's worked for a number of years. There were certainly considerations, as I mentioned before, plaintiff had limited, unquestionably had, did not receive all the relief that he believed he was entitled to or sought.
Did he, the plaintiff, challenge that? I don't know the answer to that. The plaintiff, as opposed to the amicus, raised the issue of whether limited success should be jettisoned in favor of another standard.
Plaintiff did not. Just to close the loop on that thought, plaintiff had limited success in this matter. Multiple counts, multiple defendants were dismissed, and most importantly, did not recover for emotional distress damages, which were repeatedly represented to be a core reason for the suit in the first place, did not recover for front pay. So there certainly was a rational, the court's decision was based upon the feel of the trial and was tethered to objective facts and the verdict. Also, one final point, also repeatedly referred to Siegelstein, as I believe one of the justices mentioned before, and I apologize for not remembering which one this morning. There is no question that the proofs in Siegelstein were vastly different between the proofs in this matter. The proofs in Siegelstein were by experienced attorneys whose rates had been approved in prior cases. So they were experienced, the rates had been approved, and there was largely no dispute about it. But for whatever reason, the court inserted themselves into disregarded competent proofs, the undisputed competent proofs, with their own feeling of what the rate should be. And that's clearly inappropriate. That's not what happened here.
With three trials that extended over a long period of time, did the court appropriately factor in the risk of nonpayment in its treatment of the enhancement?
Yes. Plaintiff originally went for a 100% fee enhancement, which again was contrary point blank to this court's precedent about what it's entitled to. And the appropriate range, which I believe was originally set in Rendine and reiterated several times thereafter. So the court considered that factor and specifically rejected defendant's contention that plaintiff had taken unreasonable settlement positions to mitigate the risk. So it's defendant's position that the court certainly validly considered the risk of nonpayment. Just briefly touching upon the 211-4 issue, there is no inherent incompatibility between the rule and fee shifting statutes. The only time an incompatibility could arise is if a party fails to comply with the rule and file a fee application timely.
Is there any purpose that's served by requiring a party to file for the fee application before they're a prevailing party?
There is. The only perceived the possibility is that the appellate division may give instruction or comment upon remand as part of the remand order to the trial court.
At the time of the application, before they're a prevailing party.
Before they're a prevailing party, may have.
Have you seen that happen?
These decisions are not published or even unpublished for that matter. I have not seen that happen. Plaintiff gave three examples that there were no such directions, but it's always the possibility. And then the only other conceivable reason would be if where there is a dispute where it's not clear if the prevailing if the plaintiff or the fee-seeking party is prevailing.
Would it make more sense to amend the rule to allow for an application at the trial court level after the remand is determined and the person and the party has prevailed?
Yes.
And if we were to do that as part of this case, would you be harmed if it applied in this matter?
Well, I think it would be a departure from the usual rulemaking process in terms of notice to the bar and the discussion about what the permutations would be and how it should be done. So, of course, my client would be harmed in the sense that it may be on the hook for we're going to have to do another fee application or respond to fees that were barred by operation of court rule precedent that had been in place for 26 years. So that's kind of, that's a bit of harm.
Aside from the fact that you are hoping to not have to answer to it altogether, would you be harmed? It was a LAD case, you were on notice that fees were an issue. It's hardly a surprise.
Of course not. It would be part of the application. But then, so we would have to then, plaintiff doesn't want it to go back to Judge Grasso-Jones. We would still have all these other issues pending as to what the appropriate hourly rate is, but there would be no fundamental harm. There'd just be a lot of issues that
position on going back to the same judge is what?
We would have no problem going back. We think the judge did we lost the case. We thought the judge did an incredible job and did far more work than we could have hoped she would have. I don't think there's another case out there where we've seen a 40-something page line-by-line ruling going through each line of the fees. So we think the judge was very fair and very reasonable. As I mentioned before, gave plaintiff ample opportunity to satisfy the deficiencies in her proofs and really scrutinized everything. So we would have no problem going back to the trial court in Monmouth County, Judge Grasso-Jones.
If it went back, are there any determinations the judge did make that should be law of the case, like in terms of, for example, computing the reasonableness of the hours? Is it all up for grabs if it went back?
We would say everything's been settled. I mean, obviously we don't know what this court's decision is going to be, but as of before I came in this morning, everything would have been law of the case. The court set the rate. The only thing would be for the court to do is to go through and determine the hours. The hours were not scrutinized in the same fashion that other time was. there would be a hope that plaintiff's counsel would address some of the issues that the plaintiff had identified, that the court had identified previously, excessive billing for more than 24 hours in a day. I mean, and the impossibility of that would be addressed before the submission gets made to the court again. But otherwise, everything's settled except for the final number of hours.
What about carving out, for example, hourly rate, whether the multiplier was appropriate or fair or adequate? Those are the main ones. And the line-by-line review, perhaps, of the billings might not be necessary, right?
Right. So we think everything's set except the number of hours.
Well, and the multiplier.
And the multiplier, well.
Which is a very significant part of the formula, right?
The court set the multiplier. I don't know if they work on the appellate fees or the appellate work would significantly affect the multiplier compared to the, I mean, whether or not it would affect the entirety of the case that the court looked at already. I don't have anything further unless the court's.
You're under 20 minutes. What do you know?
I apologize. Everyone's stomach.
No apology needed. Ms. Campbell, rebuttal.
May it please the court, I would just like to address a few things that defense counsel said. First of all, there were not repeated submissions. Any submission after the reply, which I'm entitled to submit, were submissions that the judge asked me to submit. For example, Judge Grasso Jones asked me to submit updated billing with respect to the billing and expenses I had incurred.
Yeah, I didn't hear him to say that it was repeated. The sense I got of what he was recounting is that the judge asked you for some additional specific things, and when the judge made her decision, it was based upon those additional items that she had asked you for, as well as your original submission.
Actually, I think that's incorrect, Your Honor, because I've heard this argument before. The repeated submissions that he was referring to were my reply. The judge then asked me to update the billing with respect to hours incurred defending post-trial motions filed by the defendants. The judge asked me to submit copies of all of my invoices to support the disbursements that I billed. The judge then asked me, I believe three times, to update post-trial prejudgment interest.
I think that's what defense counsel is arguing, that even after repeated requests from the trial judge to get additional information to assist her in making a determination with regard to the appropriate rate, she was still left in a scenario where she did not have the information that she was seeking or needed in order to make her determination.
I understand that, Your Honor, but respectfully, the judge never asked me for additional information on the rate or on the justification for the rate. The judge asked me for five different things after all of the initial submissions were submitted, never asked me for anything else regarding the rate or regarding additional certifications. Counsel referenced that the two certifications that I submitted from unaffiliated attorneys. He said that one attorney is not in the New Jersey market. That's untrue. Mr. Horan has been practicing in New Jersey since 1993. I've handled cases with him in New Jersey throughout that time. We used to work together, and the other attorney practiced employment law in New Jersey for many years. So she compared what her rate was when she practiced based on her experience in comparison to my experience. Counsel also referenced that my rate is $200 more than the highest rate ever approved. That also is incorrect, and I referenced this on page 6, footnote 1 of my reply brief in the lower court, that in 2011, 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, a rate of $600 an hour was approved. Counsel also incorrectly stated that regarding limited success, that the jury didn't give my client any front pay. That's because they gave him the entire amount that he asked for, plus, I believe, another $20,000, but categorized it all as back pay. So they gave him everything he asked for with respect to lost earnings. And as far as his reference to Siegelstein, the trial judge in that case, even though the certifications counsel claims were more detailed, the trial judge in Siegelstein rejected them, saying they provided, quote, no meaningful information. And I'd also like to reference the enhancement or the multiplier. There was no multiplier in this case because after the trial judge reduced the billable hours by over 1,000, cutting them in half, the judge applied an additional 20% reduction over and above that, and then provided a 20% enhancement, which canceled, those two canceled each other out. So there was no enhancement in this case. And the law does not provide that you can reduce the hours by half on an individual basis and put an across-the-board reduction on the decision as well. It's one or the other. And I think counsel referenced that he hasn't seen an extensive review. I think he mentioned, I think it was about 70 pages, the review. And that's probably because we haven't seen cases where they're tried three times and go back and forth to the appellate division over 14 years. This case, prior to the second trial in 2017, was the oldest case in Monmouth County. We got a notice saying we could not request an adjournment of the trial date because this was the oldest case in Monmouth County. And ultimately, two more things. Number one, I understand the court's concern with my submissions and the judge's non-reliance on them, but ultimately, the judge set the rate and did so based on an improper comparison, using an unpublished case and personal opinion. And as far as the 24 hours in a day billing, those were billed over several days. And because it was on one project, and this happened multiple times, because it was one project, I billed it all together with great detail. And this court has said that the block billing is okay as long as there's enough detail to show what you were doing. And I went back through the bill when I was finalizing it and put in the number of pages on the, say that the billing was for opposing a motion or reviewing a motion. I put the number of pages. If it was for transcripts, put the number of pages of the transcripts. So I provided as much detail as possible. So it's not as though, you know, I said preparing for trial 24 hours. That's misleading. And those are all of the things I wanted to address on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel.
Your Honor?
Yes, Mr. Green.
30 seconds, and it's just a reference to the record and based on what Mr.
I'm nervous because Mr. Shalom is going to get some ideas for
this. No, it has nothing to do with what they...
No, that's not what I'm nervous about.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right, Mr. Burke mentions to the effect about how the settlement negotiations entered into play, and therefore, I just want to point to the record, Your Honor. This is actually one thing I do agree with the Law Division judge. It's at page 88 of the plaintiff's appendix, and I'm going to quote this. It would be mere speculation for the court to conclude that if plaintiff had significantly reduced his settlement demand, defendants would have substantially increased the settlement offer and the matter would have settled. The only point I want to make is that settlement should not, and I did put this in my brief, settlement negotiation should not enter into the equation when determining the ultimate fee.
Thank you again to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.